You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Thursday, April 12th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Why are we live to tape? Because right now I am living it up, hanging out with my 6.5-year-old daughter, probably listening to Selena Gomez for the 5,000th time. Maybe I'm watching the same Phineas and Ferb episode over and over again. Maybe I'm drawing funny pictures of myself. Maybe I'm trying desperately to take a nap for once, just to get her to stop talking and bothering me. I don't know, but I'm sure in my own way I'm enjoying it. But alas, I haven't forgotten you, the faithful Majority Report listener, because today we have three great interviews for you. Well, two great interviews for you riffraff. Three great interviews for you Majority Report members. We'll be talking to Mac McClellan. She is the human rights reporter for Mother Jones Magazine on her piece in Mother Jones Magazine entitled, "I Was a Warehouse Wage Slave." Also, Bill Lozonik, professor and director of Center for Industrial Competitiveness, professor at UMass Lowell, on the failure of corporations to function as citizens in our society. And then later, for members, you'll be hearing an interview I did with Ron Pollack. He is the executive director of Families USA, an interview we did while the Supreme Court was hearing arguments as to the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act about a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago now. So sit back and enjoy. First up, making corporations work for the economy, we've got William Lozonik. He, again, is a professor from UMass Lowell and a director of the Center for Industrial Competitiveness. And then we'll hear from Mac McClellan on being a wage slave in a warehouse. And then you members will have the opportunity to hear Ron Pollack. Make sure you tune in tomorrow. That is Friday. Great interview with Thomas Frank, author of Pity the Billionaire and What's the Matter with Kansas, on essentially the capacity for our establishment, both the press and the leaders of this country, to continually fail upwards. In fact, that's not a bug, but a feature. And we'll be talking to him tomorrow, Friday. But sit back. Here is my interview with Bill Lozonik.
Mm-hmm.
So, Bill, give me a sense of just how profitable U.S. corporations, and I should say we're talking about public corporations here, just how profitable they've been this year as opposed to 50 years ago, let's say.
Well, yeah, I don't have those the exact numbers at my fingertips. And, of course, the amount of profits, profits on assets, whatever. Corporations were generally profitable 50 years ago. They're generally profitable now. If they aren't profitable, we don't have even the chance of having a prosperous economy. Because basically, profits are so that they can generate more revenues than costs, and no business can survive for long if it can't do that. But that having been said, there's a question of how you can be profitable for a long period of time and how you get profitable. And first of all, there's a lot of costs that don't show up on the profit and loss statements of business corporations because basically they've been funded by the government, by taxpayers who have funded the education system, funded the S&T, science and technology infrastructure, funded roads, funded airports, funded all manner of things that corporations use. Now,
I want to just stop you there for a moment because the point that you're making is that there is no corporation that exists in this country that is profitable in a vacuum. It is all, in some regard, every corporation, every dollar of profit that's made by a public or probably even private, but certainly a public corporation in this country, is a function of some type of investment that's been made by society, been made by our government, which essentially means been made by taxpayers.
That's right, anybody who does anything, any individual, any company, you walk on the sidewalk. You're not falling into holes. It's because someone built those sidewalks. Now we pay taxpayers' money, build them, and then what we do is we tax individuals and companies from their income to basically maintain the level of infrastructure spending, and also in a global economy where you're competing against lots of other countries that want to make those profits, want to produce the products, want to create the jobs, so that you can stay up with them and maybe even ahead of them. And a lot of the investment that's made is, in fact, not simply concrete, but it's in knowledge, it's in education of the labor force, it's in new technologies that often when the investments are made, they're long before business is even thinking of these things as being potentially profitable. In fact, they often don't even know what they'll be profitable for. So you have like the computer revolution. You've had decades of government investment in computer technology before, in fact, we all saw, microcomputers, PCs on our desks. The same with the internet, the same with smartphones, anything that people are using. There's been a lot of investment that's been made to get us to the point where a company can go and produce those products, and if it does it well, make a profit.
And that was part of, I guess, an implicit, almost a secondary social contract. I mean, we as taxpayers will fund a society, a functioning society, so that it provides the opportunity for capitalists to create these companies to make profit from it. And if I'm a company that doesn't use roads that much, if transportation for some reason is not terribly important to me, as a taxpayer, I still subsidize those companies that rely on a strong surface transportation system for their businesses. And part of that implicit compact was that these corporations, and the benefit of this sort of largesse at the by the state, was that it comes back into society in the form of these corporations employing people and essentially giving them an opportunity to work and to make money.
Yeah, and for us then to potentially have a high standard of living in general. And I would say, it's a social contract. I would say in the past, it was much more explicit than implicit. And basically what's made it now, people forget that you can't have a prosperous society. You need both government and business. And what's made people forget this is really an ideology that comes out of business now, which wasn't really there 50 years ago, that it's only business that creates this wealth. And in fact, it even goes further than that. You take some high-tech company, and all of a sudden it's only the entrepreneur that mattered. Nobody else mattered. Everybody else is dispensable. Now, that's a nice ideology to have if you're the entrepreneur or you're the ones who are trying to grab the money, but it's not actually the way things work. And in fact, that ideology of kind of just one individual doing things and all that money belongs to that individual or to a corporation, and then the executives at the top, well, we created all that money. Without us, none of that would have been created. Then we have to get paid $20 million a year or more. That's a very self-serving ideology. It doesn't square with the facts of how, in fact, these companies became successful. And it also actually doesn't square with the facts of how they can remain successful. I mean, they can't remain successful because somebody at the top is keeping their stock price up. In fact, that's a recipe for them falling behind.
Well, let's get into that. I mean, I want to get into that in just a moment, but I just want to make sure that that people understand that there was a time, and we don't have particularly over the past 10 years, it's quite we've seen corporate profits continually to but for the financial crisis and since have rebounded, we've seen corporate profits continue to increase, we've seen productivity continue to increase, yet we've seen a stagnation in wages. And so and we've seen a continued job loss, or I should say a shrinking of the amount of good paying, stable jobs. And so something is clearly broken down. And there was a time in this country where there was a mentality that corporations had, that the people who ran these corporations, maybe it's better to say, had, which was that they understood that the fates of their workers and the fates of the corporations were inexorably intertwined.
That's right. And, since we were talking about, government expenditure needs to be funded by taxation, the one figure, which I'm sure you're aware of and most of your listeners are aware of, but if they're not, they should be, was that in the 1950s, the top personal income tax rate was 91%. Now, that wasn't forced on the elite of the country, and of course, they always were looking for loopholes, like everybody always is, but nevertheless, there was an understanding among those who ran corporations, among people in government, who they influenced a lot back then, just like they do now, that without the people who had the money funding this investment for the future, there wouldn't be a future. Now, basically, that we've created the future and we're facing now a lot more global competition than we used to, the people who control these corporations are trying to pretend that the future doesn't depend on this kind of investment by the government, or if it's going to depend on the investment in the government, they're not the ones. The ones with the money aren't the ones that need to make it. And by the way, if you look at the long-term change in tax rates, and of course, now we see the United States as a low-tax rate economy, whereas before it was high tax rate. How did that become possible? Basically, it became possible because starting with the oil price increases of the 1970s and all the petrodollars that were out there, and then the Japanese becoming lenders to the United States, and now the Chinese becoming lenders to the United States, we could borrow from other people to fund government deficits rather than having to say that we have to pay for this ourselves.
Right, and one of the ways that we have made up for stagnating wages, or one of the ways we did, was essentially via cheap credit. When we sadly, that bubble burst, at least in terms of the cheap credit we were pulling out of our homes. But we have to take a break. When we come back, I want to outline exactly what were the practical changes that took place over the past 50 years that created a different incentive structure for the heads of these corporations, where they no longer thought it was in their best interest, where their interests were no longer aligned with those interests of the rest of society. We got to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Bill Lozonik. So, Bill, when we broke, we had talked about how there was a time in this country where those people who led corporations, and we're talking about CEOs, we're talking about upper management, we're talking about board of directors, perceived the success of the corporation in a much longer time frame. And because they were looking at a future for this country, for the corporation, they also understood that their interests aligned with those of the rest of the people in the country, whether they were their consumers or their workers. But something changed. What changed, and when did it happen?
Well, a number of things changed. One, with the corporation itself. A corporation is successful, is going to grow. And at some point, it actually can become too big become an unwieldy conglomerate, which happened in many companies in the 1960s. And sometimes it actually can be made to be too big by someone coming in and saying, oh, I'm just going to buy up a bunch of corporations. And this happened in the 1960s. So I had traced a lot of the changes that have led us to where we are now back to the 1960s, when you had something called the conglomerate movement. Where in business schools they were saying a good manager can manage anything, 2 + 2 = 5, just grow the size of these corporations, get into 300 different businesses, which some actually were in, and the economy is going to do better. Now, it turned out.
And the theory was, too, that it would make these companies more efficient and more profitable, but in fact, that wasn't really the case, was it?
Yeah, no, there were different arguments. You know, this is a more efficient allocation of capital, internal capital markets, and stuff like this. But it didn't work because. Basically, when people are running a corporation and have to figure out what kind of technology to invest in, what kind of organization to build, what kind of people to hire, how to train people, they have to understand those businesses. So that notion, which did go around the business schools in the 60s of you can manage everything, everybody now recognizes that was nonsense. But it was used to justify basically some people making lots and lots of money just by buying and selling companies. And in the 1970s and 1980s, resulted in basically deconglomeration, companies being sold off. And ultimately, it led to actually the rise of the junk bond market, Michael Milken, breaking company, buying up, taking over companies, breaking them apart. It led to a whole bunch of things which were in some ways seen as a correction to the conglomerate movement, but actually we're actually making things even worse, because now people were trying to make money by just building up these big corporations which couldn't be run properly. All they were into was making money by breaking them apart, even if that meant laying off tens of thousands of workers, destroying their capabilities. So that's one of the things that happened. This happened within these large corporations, and you started getting people at the top of these corporations who said, hey, I like this idea that the only thing that matters is the value we create for shareholders, our profits, our stock price, because this gives me a free rein to do whatever I want with this company, and I can make lots of money. So this is the second thing.
We should say, obviously, somebody doesn't want free rein for the sake of free rein. Yes. It just they realized that they were no longer bound by this sort of explicit, implicit, however you like it, social contract. And really, at the end of the day, they started to realize that these corporations were just essentially, they hadn't been invented yet, but ATMs. They were just ways in which they could sort of monetize them almost with their own cottage businesses.
That's right. And this is the second thing is the way, which I talked about another time when we was interviewed by you, that executives started getting paid. Now, there was an attempt starting in 1950 to pay executives with stock options. It was really a way of getting around the 91% top tax rate and getting capital gains tax rate of 25%. And executives went for that to try to, not be, have a lower rate of taxation. But Congress rebelled against this starting in the 1960s and really eliminated that by 1976. What changed was in the 1980s and 1990s in the context of the long boom of the stock market, executive stock options came back. And this time it had nothing to do with the capital gains tax rate or the personal income tax rate. In fact, virtually all stock options are taxed at the personal income tax rate, because in 1981, Congress actually put a cap of 100,000 in exercisable options per year on the amount that you could make that would be eligible for the capital gains tax rate, with lots of restrictions on it. And that might sound like, well, a chunk of change to you and me, but for top executives now who are making 10, 20 million, that doesn't quite do it. So then it simply became a question of, how can you get the stock price up, cash in your options, and make lots of money? And actually, the Security and Exchange Commission, which is supposed to regulate these markets, made things easier for executives, particularly with a ruling in 1991, which said that as insiders, top executives who previously had to hold the stock that they acquired when they exercised options for at least 6 months before they sold it, now could sell it immediately. Now, the other side of this was they also, the SEC, actually almost 10 years earlier, 9 years earlier in 1982, said to executives, and we're going to give you something that you can use to boost your stock price, which, as it turns out, will help you also boost your own earnings. And that was a safe harbor against manipulation charges if they did massive stock repurchases on of their own company stock. And as I've said in many things I've written, basically stock buybacks and stock options became the yin and yang of executive compensation.
So we had Bill. So let me just recap, because we just got a minute left here. So essentially, what we're looking at is a series of changes that took place in terms of the way the people who run corporations perceived both their responsibilities to society, but also to the corporation itself. They began to view short-term gains as being the ascendant value, because they were not restricted from operating in other ways, and they were they basically had the incentive to look short term, because that was the way they would enrich themselves and those around them at the leadership of these corporations. So let me ask you this: we just have a minute left.
Yeah.
Well, is the answer that we need to put more restrictions on corporate behavior, or is it that we need to somehow change the culture because these norms have been abused?
Well, I think we have to put restrictions on it. Now, the will, the political will to put restrictions on top executives and on the way companies are run and how they allocate resources, how they're paid, probably does require not just a change, but probably a revolution in social norms, which is a cultural phenomenon. So I wouldn't say it's one or the other, but we need to do it. And I think ultimately it's not going to be a matter of goodwill. It's going to be a matter of saying this is what you can and cannot do. And I think that once we changed what you cannot and cannot do, the types of people who are running large corporations would change. Because I think it's not simply that you have people who are the same people and can run them either way. The top corporate executives, if they actually were being rewarded for investing for the future, for creating good jobs, for retraining workers, for contributing to a prosperous economy, they would be different people than they are now. Different types of people with different mentality, different training, different relations with the labor force, different views of society. And so that's, I think, one of the big problems is that, in fact, we have, well, maybe I put a bunch of egotistical and greedy people running the economy because we've let egotistical, greedy people run the economy.
And we've rewarded them. Well, Bill Lozonek, the first step for us to sort of create a movement that is angered about this is to know where and what we are angry at. And I appreciate your filling that out for us. So joining me on the phone, it's a pleasure to welcome to the program the human rights reporter for Mother Jones, Mac McClellan, on her piece. It's a great piece, heartbreaking in a way. I was a warehouse wage slave. Welcome to the program, Mac.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with, well, tell us, you know, it's quite a piece. What, just how did it come about? You were asked to basically take a job and report on what it's like to work in one of these huge shipping warehouses.
Yeah, well, I had actually reported earlier on another one of those that I visited sort of by chance for another feature, and the conditions in it were just really abysmal and sad. And so when I got back and finished that other story, you know, my editors were like, how widespread are these practices and how widespread is this story? And I was like, well, you know, it's huge. This is just the way that it's done pretty much industry wide. And so they decided that the best way to do it would be to actually work there. So they, you know, they sent me to go get a job. So that's what I did.
And you got a job at the Amalgamated Product Giant Shipping Worldwide Inc. warehouse.
Well, that's what we had to call it. We were advised, strongly advised by our lawyers not to name the actual major company that I was working for. So we gave it that sort of, you know, outlandish pseudonym.
Okay, I was going to say, that sounds almost like a parody.
Exactly.
So obviously, this is a company that we would, we'd all be familiar with.
Yes.
And is this a warehouse that is owned by a specific company, or is it one that sort of provides services to multiple online companies?
Well, even the warehouses that are owned by companies, Amazon, for example, runs a lot of, they run their own fulfillment centers. But even the Amazon fulfillment centers actually contract to do fulfillment for a lot of other online places because they, you know, they sort of, they do it best. They're one of the leaders at this time. So if you were a smaller company and you needed someone to do your online fulfillment, because everybody needs someone to ship their orders now because you have to be able to sell anything on the internet. So even in an Amazon warehouse that is Amazon owned and run, there's still products from other companies because those companies can pay Amazon to do it for them. So, and a lot of them are big mixes of, you know, speaking of amalgamated, you know, they're big mixes of lots of companies because the third-party logistics contractors that run them, you know, will run many contracts through the same warehouse space that they own. So it's generally, I think it's a little bit hard to find one that's totally pure.
Okay, so let me see if we can just sort of draw this out where the different sort of parts are. I go to a website, I go to majoritypublic.com, I'm buying, you know, some merchandise,
And the majority report has contracted an e-fulfillment service, mm-hmm. and the e-fulfillment service goes to this warehouse. Is that the way it works?
Yeah, basically. So it could be the third-party logistics contractors can be – there's a lot of them, and they're massive. And mostly they're owned by shipping companies, actually. So the biggest one in the United States is called Excel. It's actually part of DHL. And so your e-commerce fulfillment, whatever service, could hire a third-party logistics contractor like Excel to do it. And so Excel would have contracts also with Walmart, for example. And so your majority report merchandise could be in the same warehouse as, you know, 10 other, you know, some Amazon stuff could go through there. There could be Target stuff in there, Zappos, like who knows. And it's all serviced out through this same space. The Amazon warehouses are a little bit more, you know, Amazon-centric, mm-hmm. but they're always all basically, you know, anywhere that doesn't do their own in-house shipping, which is almost nowhere, you know, right now, uses one of these giant companies to do the shipping for them.
And one of the benefits of that, of course, is that when a story like yours comes out that shows that the working conditions there are pretty bad and oppressive, that their name doesn't come up in the story so much.
That's right. Well, the thing is that when journalists go to work for companies and don't tell the companies that they're journalists, historically, when the companies sue those journalists, the journalists lose. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, it was based on case law, basically, that our lawyers were like, you probably just didn't mention who they are. But at the same time, yeah, it doesn't really matter because they're all like this. So naming one sort of, you know, targets one company when, in fact, all the companies are pretty much the same. So it doesn't really matter, like, which company you use. They have to do it the cheapest way. And the cheapest way is, unfortunately, generally the meanest way.
Yeah, all right. So let's get to that. Give us an example. How long did you end up working at this warehouse?
I only worked there for, like, 36 hours or something. I had to wait for, you know, I had a certain period of time in which to complete this assignment, and they drug tested me, and they did spit instead of urine, so it takes longer. So I had to basically wait to be, you know, to make sure that I'm not a pot smoker for a week before I could start my employment.
Okay, wait, no. I asked you, how long did you actually work there?
Like 36 hours.
Oh, that's
like
it. Okay. So,
well, I mean, no, of actually on the floor, so like 4 days.
Okay. So so tell me about what you experienced there. What was the give us the general sense of the place.
Well, it's sort of disposable human culture. You know, nobody knows who anybody is because there's thousands of people who work there. And in addition just to the sheer numbers of it, a lot of those people are temps, you know, they're temporary workers, and so they just cycle in on this sort of fire and hire model where you just go through thousands. Like in the last 4 months of last year, the one warehouse I was working in cycled through 4,000 temporary workers. So people are just coming and going constantly.
Let me ask you about that. Now, so how many yeah? people are working there at any given time?
3,000.
3,000. And so why is it that they use temporary workers there? In other words, are there people who work there 12 months out of the year? Are there people who get 3 months every year? Why and how does that work that way?
Sure. There are some people who work there year round, but there are a lot of temps, partly because, you know, online commerce, just like regular, you know, mall stores, there's a big, you know, there's peak seasons, and so you need more people over Christmas, way more people over Christmas than you need through the rest of the year. So that's one of the reasons, so that because if you had real employees, they would want to be paid year-round, and you wouldn't want to pay them unless you absolutely needed them. So that's one of the reasons for temps. But they also use temps all the time, not just during peak seasons. And the reason for that is that it's cheapest. You don't have to give temps real benefits. You don't have to give them paid time off. You don't have to give them vacation. You can pay them very, very little. It's almost impossible for them to organize, you know, because they're just temporary assignments. So it's not like they're going to demand better wages because they can be fired in an instant. So it's just them, and also it keeps the association with the labor conditions off of the actual company. So even if you were shipping Walmart stuff, you probably wouldn't be working for Walmart. You would be working for a temporary staffing agency that was hired by the third-party logistics contractor that was hired by Walmart. So there's all these degrees of separation of responsibility for how these people are being treated.
And let's talk about that. It's backbreaking work. It is incredibly. You get just moments, basically. It seems like in any given day as a break. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's very much like a cattle call. You know, like everybody has to sort of mass in the beginning and then just run to their stations and clock in. You can't clock in even a second late, because there's penalty points. You're on a demerit system, like maybe a high school student would be. So you have to be exactly on time or early. Same with lunch. You clock in and out for lunch, and you can't be 1 second late when you clock back in for lunch, or you get penalty points. And if you get enough, then you are eventually just fired. But it's not just about, manual labor is hard, because manual labor is hard, and it's important to have entry-level jobs as part of the economy. Like, you know, people need those jobs. It's an important sector for sure. But they give them goals that are just totally unreasonable, you know, in order to make it as cheap as possible. So you have to be able to fulfill more than 1,000, you know, orders worth of merchandise a day. So you're just running around this, you know, many hundred thousand square foot space picking up, you know, Barbies and paper towels and just all kinds of things as fast as you can. And then running, you know, to your 29-minute and 59-second lunch and then running back. And if you don't manage to make the goals that you have, you get yelled at. Basically,
I imagine they have some type of algorithm where the goal is sort of some percentage more than they anticipate the average person being able to do, so that you always feel that pressure.
Well, you know, I consider myself to be in pretty good shape. You know, I'm only 31, so I was like, oh, I can totally do this. And I used to work in a warehouse. I used to work manual labor. I was a mover, actually. I worked for a moving company. And so when they gave me the job that involved, you know, these crazy goals, I was like, you know, I'm on this. I can totally do it. But I could only make, you know, 50-55% of my goals. And when I was asking some of the supervisors, like, does anybody ever really make these numbers? There are people who do every single day. And a lot of the people who do are in their 50s. And, you know, they take Advil or painkillers all day so that they, you know, can sort of push through the insane amounts of, you know, you get joint pain and your shoulders hurt and your arms hurt just from crouching and bending and running for, you know, 10.5 hours is a long time to do anything, but to do it at a breakneck suicide pace is, it's incredible how hard a lot of these people work. So most of them do actually make their goals.
And do you get a bonus if you get your goals?
Yeah, I asked somebody that. If you make your goals, you are occasionally entered into a drawing for like a $10 company gift certificate.
Wow. And how much do people get paid on an hourly basis?
I was hired at 11 something an hour. It depends. You know, it depends on what state you're in. The one I was in Ohio that I visited that, you know, preceded this assignment, those people were making $9 an hour. I was definitely at the higher end at $11.50, I think I was making.
And you're not allowed to work just 8 hours there.
No, the minimum shift was 10.5, and then there was mandatory overtime. So it was 5 10.5-hour shifts in a row. So Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. So you would work, you know, you get half an hour of that 10.5 is lunch. So you work 50 hours in 5 days, plus the time that you're there eating lunch, and then you have 2 days off.
Do you get time and a half for that overtime?
Yeah, they do pay. They totally follow. At this particular, you know, there have been a lot of lawsuits at warehouses that don't follow the overtime laws, but this particular warehouse totally did. And the next week, we were starting minimum 12-hour shifts for 5 days in a row because it was, you know, it was coming up on Thanksgiving. So.
And so what's the theory? Why is it that they would hire, why would they force overtime as opposed to bringing in other workers?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure, you know, I'm not an economist, and so I don't know how the math works out on that, how it's, like, why not have three shifts instead of only two? Mm-hmm. Because it's a 24-hour warehouse, and there were only two shifts, and there was always somebody there. So I don't know what the logic of having three, you know, not having three shifts and only having two. I promise you that it's cheaper. Like, whatever the right answer is, it is definitely that it's cheaper. I'm not sure how that's true, but, you know, I'm an English major, but I'm sure that's what it is.
Yeah, I suspect if you've got to hire that many more people, there may present some pressure on wages upwards. But
maybe that's true. I mean, they have... You know, part of the thing is that they tell you, you know, you have to behave, you have to make your goals, you can't complain, and you can't demand anything. And the reason that that's true is because, you know, there's 16 other people who need to take your job and want to take your job and will take it because the economy is so bad. So if they were filling that many more jobs, that would take some of – I mean, this was a small town. You know, there was not that many, this was not that big of an area, and there were already people coming from really far away. So maybe the market in that area wouldn't bear that many positions with that terrible of conditions. It is possible.
One point, I think, in the piece you ask, does OSHA have any regulation? Because you talk about being on your feet for 10 hours. You talk about the strain physically on these people. You know, we have a sense of OSHA, you know, providing regulations in terms of ergonomics and in terms of worker safety and overall health. I mean, is this place regulated by OSHA? How is it that people are allowed to function this way?
Well, there's no laws for ergonomics because it is ergonomics. And it's not just, you know, on your feet. Yeah, it's a long time to be on your feet, but it's also a long time to be on your knees. And a lot of the merchandise is kept on the, like, literally on the floor. And if you have to pick a Barbie doll up off the floor, you can imagine what sort of, you know, posture you have to take. So you have to crouch or get down, you know, maybe 500 times a day, which is a lot. So I called OSHA and I was like, is this legal? And they said, there's no laws for ergonomics, just best practices. So OSHA has recommendations for how you should be, you know, paying attention to ergonomics, and you can file complaints. But there's no actual laws. And we did actually FOIA the records of OSHA complaints from this particular facility, and there were people who were complaining about it, and then OSHA comes in, and with the equipment the way that it is, you know, that's, they would have to revamp that whole, like, their whole storage system in order for it to be more comfortable, and I guess OSHA decided that the way that they had it was close enough or good enough because it's, you know, it's still operating the way that it is.
I mean, so at the end of this, well, the other question I had for you, and I think you touched on it on your piece, is sort of how much awareness of the worker experience travels up through these different layers that you talk about, whether it's, you know, going from the front end retail outlet to the fulfillment company to the temp agency. Is there an awareness through those sort of multiple layers of what it's like to work in that building?
Not usually. I mean, the people at the staffing agency, they know, you know, they definitely know. And the people who are sort of on the ground as supervisors for these, you know, the managers of these warehouses for Walmart or Amazon, they know. But people all the way up, you know, they have possibly never walked in there and certainly have never spent that much time there. I interviewed this one woman who was, you know, an e-commerce specialist, and she was a consultant, and she worked for a company that sold all their stuff online, and she herself had been in charge of hiring the people who did the shipping for them. And she was like, you know what, now that you mentioned it, I actually have no idea what the conditions are like in the warehouses of the company that I hired. We just, you know, we hire who's cheapest, and that's it. You don't even think to ask, like, how are people being treated, which is the same thing just with consumers. You know, I used to buy lots of stuff off the internet like everybody else, and it's not like I knew it was terrible, but I didn't care. It's just a no, and that's the position that I think most people are in. So we're starting to get a little bit more information, you know, out of these kinds of complexes, which is good because they're sort of taking, you know, online retail sort of taking over the retail world, right? So this is only going to be more and more common.
What was her reaction? I mean, I presume you said, like, well, I was working there. It's pretty miserable. I mean, what was her reaction to that?
Yeah, she was horrified, actually. She was like, you know, not only do I not know what it's like, I don't know anyone who would know. Like, even if I call that company and I ask them, what kind of information are they really going to give me? You know, how am I really going to find this out? And so she was saying, you know, what would be good for people like her who are in charge of hiring these places, as well as for consumers who care, because not everybody cares, but, you know, there's a segment of the population that does, would be if there was a standard that was created, because there are some people who will pay more for, like, you know, organic food, for example. So if there was a standard and then there was some sort of firm, you know, that certified these companies that way, there are some people who would pay $8 for their shipping instead of $0 for their shipping if they were really assured that people were being treated in a decent way and being, you know, paid living wages and things like that. That doesn't exist yet, but that would definitely make it a lot more, you know, a lot easier for consumers and the companies that hire these companies to sort of hire responsibly.
Well, I mean, as a journalist, I mean, do you think that, you know, sort of obviously you have, you care about these issues. Do you think is that the best route, the most realistic route? I mean, what do you think people who read your account, what they should do?
I mean, it might be the most realistic because the fact is, I mean, everybody knows that working at Walmart sucks at this point, right? Everybody knows that they don't pay their workers enough. There have been all sorts of lawsuits, but most people still shop at Walmart, but not everybody does. So it's not going to be the case that once the whole world is aware that they're using these kinds of, you know, awful labor practices to ship things online, it's not like people are just going to stop buying, because, you know, they need the money. They need to save the money. These companies need to post $1 billion profits. So people are going to keep doing it because it's cheap. But there is a segment of the population that would care and that would stay away from that sort of thing, you know, if there was an alternative. And so I think, you know, stopping it altogether is, you know, sort of like wishing for world peace, I think. But if they're, like, having an alternative develop, that is, I think, is a totally realistic
solution. Well, what do you think a consumer should do? I mean, I ask because, you know, one of the means in which we support this program is through an affiliate relationship with Amazon. I mean, relationship may be a strong word, but we get a kickback if people buy through our Amazon link. Right. And, you know, I certainly I have mixed feelings about it because there's not many opportunities, obviously, to you know, to fund a program like this, or, you know, in terms of revenue or whatnot. It's not that much money, but it's some money. But what can we do? Is it something that we should just stop doing that altogether, or is there a mechanism in which to advocate for this type of thing you're talking about?
I mean, there's always value in trying to advocate. You know, if consumers are complaining enough about something, and if the companies that work with these companies are complaining enough about something, you know, it could be some of the companies that hire these companies could say, listen, our consumers are concerned about this, and we need to be able to tell them that we're not participating in this sort of thing. So, you know, you guys need to change your practices or something. I mean, that some change, you know, can definitely come out of that sort of thing. I think it's a long time coming, kind of no matter what. But certainly, you know, people who have strong feelings about it should voice those strong feelings about it. It's, even if it's slow and, you know, doesn't seem that effective, I think it's certainly a first step.
Have you stopped buying stuff online?
You know, I bought something online like a month ago. So after I had already worked there, because I couldn't find a place that would, you know, I couldn't find a place, a brick and mortar store that existed within like 20 miles of me where I could get it. So I did. Although, you know, I've resolved to not do that in any case where it's even humanly possible to buy stuff from someplace else. So well, we're all guilty.
Yeah, that's true. Indeed. Well, Mac McClellan, reporter from Mother Jones, the piece is, I was a warehouse wage slave. My brief, backbreaking, rage-inducing, low-paying dildo packing time inside the online shipping machine. We didn't get to that element. apparently, you're going to have to read the piece to see just how many sex toys actually get shipped out of a warehouse like this. Apparently, that's big business. But appreciate your time.
Yes, thanks for having me.